Oh my God. I cannot think of a better guest at a better time today on Nowruz, the Persian New Year. And on the heels of International Women's Day, I had the honor of speaking to Dr. Nushin Ranjbar. She is Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. She is also faculty at the Center for Mind-Body Medicine. We had an extraordinary conversation about trauma, how it affects everyone, yes, even you, what the implications are to our mental, emotional, and physical health, and the mind-body practices that can heal. We also talk about the tragic humanitarian crisis happening right now in Iran and how her trainings are helping and how you can help that effort as well. As I said, this is an extraordinary conversation. You are going to find it fascinating, relatable, and actionable. So let's dig in.
Welcome back to Health Bite, my podcast where I offer you small, actionable bites towards healthy weight and weight management through greater mental, emotional, and physical well-being. I wholeheartedly believe that our relationship with food is a window into our relationship with ourselves. Understanding this relationship will not only facilitate healthy weight and weight management, but will have rippling effects that impact every aspect of your life. In the nearly two decades that I've worked as an obesity medicine specialist, I have seen firsthand the life-changing effects of this transformative work, and I'm so excited to share my insights with you. I'm your host, Dr. Adrienne Udine, and I created this podcast as an alternative to the noise to offer you knowledge-based guidance in the areas of nutrition, fitness, habit change, and mindset that I use with my patients in my medical practice every single day to help them achieve healthy weight and health. More episodes are available at dradrienneudine.com/podcast. And while you're there, sign up for my newsletter and shoot me an email. I'd love to hear about your journey. Okay, here we go. Let's dig into this week's episode.
So, Nushin Jun, I am so excited, honored, really, to have you here today to talk about yourself, about your incredible work, and offer your wisdom to our listeners.
It's an honor to be here. Hello to you and all your listeners.
Tell us a little bit about Nushin and how you entered this important work, what you do and how you got here.
Yes, my name is Nushin Ranjbar. My first name, for those who may not know, comes from the root of the Farsi words for sweetness, flower nectar, somewhere along those lines. And my last name, which I get a kick out of, means one who either takes on suffering and pain or takes away other people's suffering and pain. So depending on how you see it, it might actually be a really good thing or a really horrible thing. Which, you know, as I'm growing into my work and my personal professional life, I'm seeing that that a lot of times both things can be true. It's not one or the other. And I'm a child adult integrative psychiatrist. I live in Tucson, Arizona. I'm originally from Iran. And my passion is healing and trauma, supporting people to be born again into a new version of themselves. And it is the most meaningful thing I could see myself doing with my life. So that's why I do it.
I mean, I think your name is so apt because, as I mentioned before we started recording, you are pure heart and pure sweetness. And your work very much has been created to help eliminate suffering. And so that is so apt as well. I'm curious, how you got into this work of trauma?
I think that it is my own journey of being born again into my new self that has everything to do with why this is so important to me to pass on to others. I never really realized that I too had traumas because growing up, it wasn't called that. No one talked about it in those terms. So really the awareness, the recognition, the appreciation and the healing can't even begin until you realize what it is. So I'm the poster child for both the darkness and the light. And I can say more about any of those pieces, but it's I feel strongly that people who do what they are here to do in the world with all their heart, it's because it has a deep personal meaning. It is the case for me too.
Absolutely. And as you started speaking, I was thinking the same, that so many of us who are so very passionate about what we do, it comes from, of course, a desire to help, but it also comes from a desire to share and to alleviate our own challenges, always or often very much a personal intention that we try and bring to others as well. I'd love for you to talk more about trauma, what it means, and expand on that, because you're right, trauma is a word that now we hear quite often. It's like every other meme on Instagram. I think it's important to make the word accessible because, to your point, it is everybody's experience, but also not to trivialize it. So say more.
Yeah, you know, definition-wise, trauma at its base means injury or hurt. You know, imagine when you think about someone feeling hurt or being injured, there are a gazillion ways that that can happen. So you can think of, you know, getting hit by a baseball bat and that could be an injury. You can think of a more of an emotional one, like a sudden loss of someone you love, a loss like a divorce or a change of job that comes in a hurtful way in some form. And then it can be other things. You know, there's the whole field of traumatic brain injury is like when our brain actually gets injured in a way that an MRI or a CAT scan or something can show on. So we believe it. It can be something that we don't even remember happened to us, like bullying in school when we were 5 or 8 or 10. It can also be something much more collective, like the pandemic for some people, for many people, because it came with a big shift, a big change, unexpected change of relationships and social life and losing a bunch of people because one happened to live in a place that many people died, you know, that we knew. All of those things can, on some level, be traumatic for some people and more for others, perhaps less for others. And there's something really powerful about trauma that, you know, it's universal. There is no human that is never hurt, right? You know, it could be, they say, little t trauma, the little things that hurt us, or it could be the big things. And for somebody, for one person, some hurt could be a little t. For someone else, that same hurt could be a big t. So it takes into account the field of traumatology and appreciation of trauma, takes into effect individual variations, genetic variations, cultural variations, spiritual ways that people understand what happened to them or what's happening in the world around them. And so it's a field that is painful, you know, like it's not about beautiful things that happen to us, but it is also because it's so universal, it's a birthing ground, it's a fertile ground for humanities and the arts and layers of human understanding and poetry and medicine and music and art and healing. But the word itself, you know, is just a hurt. And I have to say this, I love sharing about the Indigenous perspective on these things, because I've learned a lot from tribal people. And I remember one of the things that really stood out to me is being reminded by an Indigenous elder woman that our very first trauma for every human being is being born. That to go from the womb that is ideally the safest place we'll ever be, where everything's provided, we don't have to cry for people to know we need food. Hopefully, you know, there's plenty of amniotic fluid and there's plenty of nourishment coming from our loving mother. We go from that through a very narrow channel with pain and screaming and being squeezed literally out into a world where everything is new. We have no idea which way is up. We are at the mercy of somebody to care for us and to understand us and to be tuned in enough to change the diaper when it's needed and to feed and to keep things quiet so we're not bombarded with chaos. There is no bigger trauma than the fact that we all have to come into this world. And most of us don't think of that as a trauma at all. You know, we don't even, a lot of people, when as a psychiatrist, so, you know, I train other psychiatrists to how to be more trauma sensitive. And so a lot of times I say when they're filling out the intake form for a patient and they come to me and say, you know, in the section of trauma, it says none. You know, the person said they have not had any traumas. And it's become like my cliche. I'm like, do you think that's possible? You know, and it takes enough safety, enough awareness, enough inner connection for us to even begin to realize that we all came here with our first trauma.
And so, permission, I think, right? Permission. I mean, even as I hear you speak, and as you know, we'll talk about the training that your center does, and even having done the training recently, I can sense inside me this kind of, you know, pushback, for lack of a better word. Because in my mind, on some level, when I think of trauma, I still think of the big traumas like the horrors of war or, you know, sexual abuse and things of that sort. But these traumas that can be that may not be as catastrophic, like being bullied for the majority of your life and self-deprecating as a result, 365 days a year for your entire elementary school experience. And I've talked about this in my book, Hungry for More. This was a personal experience for me. It is an act of self-compassion as well as an act of, I don't know if I'm using the wrong word, but the thought that comes to mind, the word that comes to mind is kind of charity and kindness to those around us to acknowledge the trauma. It's not only self-care, but it's also caring for the people around us. And you're shaking your head, so I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Hi, friends. It's Dr. Adrienne, and I'm dropping into your podcast to offer a love letter to you. I believe that our hunger represents our unmet emotional and spiritual needs. And by leaning in and listening to our hunger, we have an opportunity to hear our needs and to respond. I know this not only from personal experience, but from listening to the stories of hundreds, if not thousands of patients over the past almost 20 years. I have compiled these stories, including my own, into Hungry for More, Stories in Science to Inspire Weight Loss from the Inside Out. This book is not just about weight loss, but about life, and contains lessons that I know to be life-changing. If you don't believe me, head over to my website at dradrianudim.com, where you can obtain a free sample, or to amazon.com and check out the reviews for yourself.
Well, you know, it's reminding me that, you know, we're not just individuals. We are also kind of all rotating in a soup of society, of hopefully evolution of society. And the reason I'm thinking of that is that in the field of traumatology or trauma studies in psychiatry history, the first traumas that were identified were wars. That is all we started out with, probably because World War I and World War II were so damaging, you know, to humans on a large scale that it made the scientists think, oh, like, this is interesting. You know, maybe we should pay attention to the shell shock, and maybe we should pay attention to the, you know, people who come back from the war and, you know, their eyes seem to be working okay, but they can't see anything or whatever. So usually, you know, the way I'm noticing is that it takes a level of universal consciousness, energy, recognition for things to start moving. And that's just the beginning, because then, you know, 200 years later, 300 years later, like, oh, that was just the most obvious kind of trauma. We could study it, and we can look at all the people who went to war and came back, because it's easy to study that. And then now, so many years later, we are beginning to recognize that if we only focus on that as the trauma, well, guess what? Then there's adverse childhood experiences, and then there's pandemics, and then there is, you know, the challenges of social media and being bullied, and like, none of that is war. And it is all impacting our nervous systems, our entire mind, body, spirit in many ways. And we need to like begin to pay attention to it, or else, you know, we are dealing with another hurt society that, you know, is numbing, using ways to not feel the pain, which can go down the addiction path or the whatever path that humans, you know, out of frustration, out of desperation, not knowing what to do with the feelings, with the pain. If they were raised in societies and families where no one taught them how to express, how to release, they got to do something with it. So then, you know, you have all of the repercussions that trauma can have. But it started with study of wars.
I want to get back, hopefully, to the idea and the conversation around soothing and addiction and just soothing. I mean, whether you want to call it, I think addiction sometimes is a loaded word, whether you want to call it an addiction or not, just I think the epidemic of soothing that we're in right now, whether it's with more, quote, harmful substances, opioids and prescription drugs, or street drugs, or more seemingly benign alcohol, which I don't know how benign that is. We're learning that it's not. Versus food. I mean, there's so much that we could talk about. But first, because I am that white coat doctor who really got intrigued by all of this because of the evidence, you know, and I think for some of our listeners, it will validate the experience and maybe encourage them to pursue this area personally. Just tell us a little bit about, you know, what we have learned in terms of
what trauma does, its implications to not only emotional and mental well-being, which may be an easy conclusion, but, you know, physical health and well-being. Can you talk a little bit about the science of that?
Yeah. You know, the gist of it is that trauma impacts everything. So from on a nervous system level, how well our brain and nervous system is able to handle the next stressor and the next stressor that comes. What happens with one trauma impacts those. And not only what happens when we're traumatized, but how that trauma is dealt with has a huge repercussion on how we will then be able to deal with the next thing. You know, in scientific terms, our sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, which are kind of the gas pedal and the brake pedal of our ability to rev up our system to deal with a situation and then slow down and get relaxed enough to be able to rest and digest and reproduce and enjoy life. That sympathetic, parasympathetic gas pedal, brake pedal balance can get really thrown off when there is a traumatic incident in our lives. So sometimes we can get stuck in the gas pedal where we become so hyperactivated, so hyper alerted, so bothered, agitated by a war, let's say, you know, people living in Ukraine right now, or people anywhere in the world where from moment to moment, you don't know if I'm going to be safe, my child's going to be safe, if my father is going to be safe. So when we live in a situation where our sense of safety is all of a sudden compromised, then some of us can go into that hyperactivation, irritability, can't sleep, can't rest well, keep replaying the situation, like maybe I should do something differently, maybe I could have prevented, you know, so-and-so from getting hurt. And those patterns can make our nerves not be able to relax very well. So people lose sleep, people get anxious, people develop panic attacks, have difficulty breathing, feel like their heart's coming out of their chest. So that's one reaction, one set of reactions to trauma. And then sometimes when the trauma is perhaps even more extreme, or we're caught off guard into a shock even more extremely, we can go into a shock response, kind of like a frozen response, like no response, like just, I mean, sometimes you hear about people who, you know, get their blood drawn or whatever for the first time and they just pass out. You know, it's like, it's not even necessarily someone trying to hurt them, but just that hurt response of like the system not knowing what to do with what just happened, for some of us can throw us into just like passing out to that point. And it also happens, sadly, in rape situations. You know, when someone's getting raped, sometimes the shock is so great that their system just freezes. And both the freeze response and that fight or flight hyperactivation response are protective. Like they're there to save our lives. They're there to help us survive whatever the situation is. So in themselves, they're actually like, we are so lucky to have them. But if we stay in those modes and we're not even aware that we're in those modes, and we don't get support to come out of those modes so that we regain a sense of equanimity and balance and restoration of our wholeness, then what happens is we get sick. So the studies show that trauma can impact every system in the body, from how we metabolize our food to how our fertility and ability to enjoy sex, have babies, get pregnant, whatever, all of that can be impacted by stress and trauma. Our cognition, our ability to pay attention, to learn things, to easily be flexible to learning new things and being open to what life has to teach us. That can be impacted when we're traumatized. Our ability to form healthy relationships with someone and actually trust the good people around us can be harmed when we've had trauma. I mean, every psychological system, every neurologic system, our gastrointestinal tract, our hormones.
Autoimmune, right? Like this, I find fascinating. You had mentioned earlier, autoimmune makes me think of the ACE studies, and you mentioned adverse childhood events earlier. I want you to talk a little bit about the link of that towards physical ailments and also the degree to which it's transmitted. You know, we talked about, I mentioned how addressing these issues is not only an act of kindness to yourself, but those around you. But one could argue that it's also an act of kindness to your progeny and your progeny's progeny. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The Adverse Childhood Experiences study, which some of the listeners might already be familiar with, was a really groundbreaking study in the 90s by Dr. Vincent Felitti and his team in San Diego. And they decided to get a sense of how common adverse childhood experiences are and what should be included as an adverse childhood experience in this research that ended up really evolving to the point of revolutionizing how we talk about trauma and how we think about it and how we try to address it. But they basically went to a pretty predominantly Caucasian middle-class population in San Diego. And they asked, in thousands of surveys, they asked people, have any of these things happened to you before you were 18? And there were things like, you know, losing a parent, getting bullied, getting sexually molested, getting physically hit or abused, living in a war situation, having your parents divorce, living in a neighborhood that was really unsafe, you know, a whole number of things. And
one's really a gamut, right? Sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to point out that it's like, it could be things like littler things, I guess, like maybe verbal abuse you could consider littler, even though it becomes a major important risk factor, more important than some of the bigger ones per se, but spans this whole risk range from not being spoken to well, to being sexually abused, to having incarcerated parents. So again, going back to what you said earlier, that there is no really defining feature in terms of severity. It's how these things impact you.
Yeah, because they can impact different people in different ways.
Right.
Yeah, so I think in the case of anxiety, they were more interested in how many of these have happened to a typical human.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think the researchers, the public, you know, didn't think what they were going to find was going to be the case. But once they did the study and they saw that even in middle-class white America, there was many more, the average number of these things that people have faced was much higher than anybody ever thought.
Right.
You know, so many percentage had four or more, and so many more had five or more. And it was like, oh my gosh, if that's the case for white middle-class America, what does that mean for the Native Americans? What does that mean for the Black population? What does that mean for the refugees who just came to this country? Anyway, so it really, and then they took those numbers and, you know, how many you've had, which I have actually had way more than I ever thought. You know, I filled out the survey and I was like, oh my God, my number is like way higher than I ever thought. And I'm a child psychiatrist. So I highly recommend if anybody wants to take it. And the beauty is that there's two surveys. There's one adverse childhood experiences and one is positive childhood experiences. Mm. So then you can do both, and then you can really see how you ended up, how well you are doing, because it's not just the bad stuff that happened. It also matters what else happened, you know? And so anyway, I won't go down that rabbit hole at the moment, but what they saw is that not only the number of people who had 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of these was much higher than expected, but also as adults, it correlated, the number of traumas you had as a child correlated to how sick you were physically as an adult. So how likely you were to have COPD, chronic lung disease, how likely you were to be on dialysis, how likely you were to have a heart attack, how likely you were to have depression or, you know, try to commit suicide, how likely you were to have an autoimmune disease like lupus or multiple sclerosis or one of these autoimmune entities. And they saw that the people with the higher ACEs score were like 10 times, 20 times, 30 times more likely to have one of these adult, you know, later life events. And it just blew everyone's mind that all the stuff that you say, oh, that was just this, that right. was just that. Like, we have not been very compassionate to ourselves as humans. Like, that was the aha moment, that we have treated ourselves pretty poorly, and our environment and our earth, and, you know, all of that comes with it, because sure. to be able to truly treat others well, it starts with how much compassion yourself. We have.
Yeah.
So that's how it came about.
Yeah. I mean, it's, aside from it being totally fascinating and, like, you know, I know the data, but still when I talk about it and think about it, it still blows my mind. But aside from it being totally fascinating, I think it is so important because, you know, if you tell women that they have a risk factor for breast cancer, or you tell them, you know, you can get a screening mammogram and prevent or detect early cancer, women are going to go get, for the most part, mammograms. And so I like to talk about this in the same terms, not to dismiss the emotional or mental health implications, but to remind people through also the physical consequences that addressing these issues that we may dismiss is as important as getting your mammogram. It's as important as taking your statin or, you know, getting your coronary calcium score. It is as, if not more important, but at least let's start there. It is as important as these other things, right? And not to mention the fact that, you know, it goes on through genetic changes to affect not only you, but your children and your children's children.
Yeah, that's the really fascinating, additionally fascinating thing, is that trauma travels. So, and it travels through many mechanisms, which in the research we're finding. So it travels through how genes are expressed in the next generation and the next generation. So, you know, we have our DNA that kind of determines what traits we have and how likely we are to get depressed or to have a heart attack, whatever. But how, whether that actually gets translated to depression or heart attack, is determined by all the stuff that's around the DNA. And the stuff that's around the DNA is impacted by our life experiences. So if we have experienced stress and trauma and we tried to put it under the rug, those same genes are going to be expressed differently, more negatively in our life than if we are lucky enough that from the time we're a child, we are taught how to express our feelings, how to breathe, how to connect with our body, how to connect with ourselves and with others in healthy ways, how to talk to ourselves in healthy ways. And that determines how well not only we live through our adult life, but how we parent our children and how our genes are traveled down to the next generation and the next generation. And it's just, you know, it takes not a sense of like guilt tripping ourselves, but an opportunity to manifest something, leave something good behind.
I love that. It's an opportunity for a kinder legacy. So people who know me personally, my listeners on the podcast, know that I am inherently an optimist. I love to wrap it up with a beautiful red bow. I know that's not always possible, but even here, it's somewhat possible. I will always find the opportunity for the red bow and to give people actionable guidance on how they can take steps to address this and actually impact change. And the center that you introduced me to and that you work for and do such important global work, which we'll get to, really has studied actionable bites that people can take home and practice. Again, having completed this work with your group recently, so grateful for that, that opportunity to have that and to share that work. So talk a little bit about what you have learned, what you advocate for, and some of the strategies that people can start to use to start their own personal healing.
Yeah, so I learned myself about this work, the Center for Mind-Body Medicine in particular, when I was a psychiatry resident about 14 years ago, because I was burned out and I was struggling to figure out why did I really want to be a doctor and a psychiatrist? And, you know, how do I help people and not just medicate everything? And is there something else I can offer? And how can I help myself, first of all, to keep that light of why I'm doing this burning and not just feel like I'm turning over, you know, one prescription paper over after another. And it was transformative for me, because when we learn skills to calm and relax simple things like the mind and the muscles of the diaphragm and different parts of the body, and we begin to utilize various ways to express ourselves through colors, through expression by words, through writing, through movement, through creating community, hearing others, learning from others, several other techniques that have evidence to help us connect more with who we are, magic happens, you know, because when our mind is relaxed, we are at our most creative. We can come up with ideas and solutions and next steps that before, when we were feeling stuck, it was almost impossible to think of, ooh, maybe I should do this. So the Center for Mind-Body Medicine was created by Dr. James Gordon 30 years ago, and he's a psychiatrist as well. makes me proud to be a psychiatrist.
I saw that.
But they go,
and rightfully so.
They go to many different places in the world where there's a lot of trauma, and they don't try to make it all better, but they train people to bring this capacity to learn, train, and support others to that community, and then allow them to make it adapted for their own culture, their own language, their own music, their own art. And it is so fun because it's really supporting communities to connect with the richness and the depth that they already have, but a lot of their strengths have been buried under trauma. So they do this in Kosovo and Gaza and Haiti and South Sudan and Jordan. I mean, you name the place that they've been. And also post 9/11, you know, for the chaos in the U.S. and post Katrina in New Orleans and post school shootings in Broward County in Florida and Sonoma fires. I mean, they're really a unique organization, if I could call them that. but they use evidence, which is the other piece. You know, I think to try to help without science behind you is a tricky business. And so to really stay with what we know, and some of these techniques draw from thousands of years of indigenous wisdom and ways that humans have survived as well, you know, the power of music and movement and sharing and meditation and imagery, and that really our body, our mind has the capacity to heal itself if given the right tools and enough safety. So that's the work that I've been involved with ever since whenever I went to my first training. And now we have programs for medical students and for doctors and for cancer patients and for people with infertility. And I mean, it's the good thing about this work is you don't have to have a diagnosis. You just have to be human and want to grow and get more in touch with your strengths. So a lot of the programs and groups are completely, doesn't matter what your challenge is. You just have to want to get to know yourself better and leave better genes for your next generation. So it's really fun work. And now I get to do it in Iran, which is where I am from originally. And it's the biggest gift to like reconnect in a positive humanitarian way with people that have been suffering, you know, forever, it feels like. But everyone's welcome to be involved if they so wish. And you don't have to be a doctor, which is another beautiful thing, is that the healing work can take many, many different forms. And everyone has the capacity to work on themselves within these spaces and then learn things that they can pass on to the kids in their community or their own family or, you know, the school system they work in or the clinic they work in.
I do want to get to the conversation around the work in Iran. And that is the way that I got connected to you. As I joke, I followed my little squirrel tendencies after I heard what you were doing, and it's beautiful work. But just to reiterate that these are simple tools: writing, drawing, coloring, breathing, moving, dancing, shaking, music, accessible to all, that are scientifically proven to help people deal with trauma, even as trauma is unfolding. And if this program has demonstrated through evidence that it is feasible in war-torn nations as war is happening. Again, it's not about putting a blanket over your eyes and ignoring the devastation or the reality of what's going on around you, but just how you relate to it. And so I really want to make the point that this is such accessible work and so powerful. So for people who are intrigued for themselves personally, right? Are there any resources that you recommend? Where can they go look? What books can they read? What programs can they look into if they are interested in pursuing this further?
Yeah, so there are several ways to begin. The website for the Center for Mind-Body Medicine is www.cmbm.org, Center for Mind-Body Medicine. They're also on Instagram and LinkedIn and Facebook and all the cool places. There are several books that Dr. James Gordon has written. The latest is Trauma Transformation, Transforming Trauma, which is powerful examples of where he's done all of this work, and together with examples of the techniques themselves and a lot of his deep wisdom as an elder in the field now. There on the center's website, there's an opportunity to look for new online groups that are just about to start that anyone can register for. You can read the bio of who the facilitator is to get to know, you know, who this trained person is that would be facilitating that group. There is a training next, a 5-day intensive online program in September. So that's another way to really jump in more intensely. And then also on the website, there are little self-care videos and actually show some of the techniques where Dr. Gordon actually does a drawing exercise with people, and you get to kind of do it along and just see what happens for you. You know, wherever you start, the next step and the next step will unfold as it has for me and many others.
Yeah. I will put a link to it in the show notes, and I really encourage people, whoever you are, wherever you're at, to look into the website, the training, and just the modules. Maybe just start there because it is really eye-opening and transformative. We've been talking for a while. I feel like we could talk forever. I have a knack, I have to say. I'm going to pat myself on the back. I have a knack for finding people that I want to connect with. And I'm really grateful to have connected with you. I want to end with, give us, you know, I've talked about this on my newsletter and, you know, a few posts on Instagram. And so can you just give us a little blurb about, for those who don't know, about what's happening right now in Iran? The work that you're doing, the fundraising that you're doing, this is really present day and really hands-on and really impactful. So tell us more.
Yeah, so there is a revolution going on in Iran, for anyone who hasn't heard. We first started calling it protests, and then the people there are like, no, we're not protesting. We are like ready for big time change. Mm-hmm. So now I call it revolution because I'm so proud of them. You know, school children, young women, young men are been coming to the streets and actually speaking their truth, which, you know, in America, even here, it's, you know, not always easy to speak one's truth. But in a society where people have been oppressed and not allowed to think or feel or wear what they wish or be who they are on a whole different scale than anything we've seen in other more developed countries, if we can call, it is a crime. It's a crime to speak your truth. And so people are killed. There are thousands of people in prisons. They say the prisons have become the universities and the universities have become the prisons. Wow. The most learned, the best doctors, the best lawyers are all in prison because they have found a way to speak up. And yeah, anyway, so, but the people, the courage is phenomenal. Because
tremendous.
Yeah. They are done and they are having something to teach the entire rest of the world, which is what makes me very proud to be Iranian these days. So what are we doing is we are bringing and offering these intensive professional trainings and supervision and mentorship and community building and leadership building to professionals in Iran so that then they can help build a new Iran that is more aware, where people, you know, can work through their traumas and have tools and skills to help the children and the adults for decades to come. Because this is, even though we call it a revolution, it's really going to be a long haul of building a new society. And I get to be one of the people who's helping with this. And we have an amazing fundraising opportunity that is going viral called Cook for Iran, which invites the beauty of the Persian culture and food as a way to bring awareness to what's going on in Iran, but also give people an opportunity to be part of it by making however small a donation that goes towards scholarships for hundreds of students, teachers, doctors, nurses, activists who are on a waiting list to go through these trainings and bring the gift to their people.
I mean, it's tremendous. And I too am so proud. I'm so proud to be an Iranian woman, and I'm so proud of you and the work that you're doing and just, I keep thinking of the impact, you know, going back to what we said earlier, this is not just giving people tools to manage present day atrocities. This is an opportunity to change the trajectory of their children and their children's children. And I can't imagine a more beautiful legacy than that. So I want to extend my gratitude to you, to your colleagues, to the Center of Mind Body Medicine for doing this work. We're going to put links to all of this information in the show notes, including how people can contribute to this cause. And again, reiterate and re-encourage our listeners to do this work for themselves by visiting the website and taking a look for themselves at the work that can be done. It really is beautiful and important work. Nooshin Jun, Dr. Ranjbar, but I'd rather just call you Jun. Thank you so very much for being here and for all the work that you do.
Thank you for having me and being an angel that passes on this wonderful opportunity to many, many people out there and practicing what you preach. Thank you, Azzy.
My honor and my pleasure.